Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's joining us here for our weekly show, The Tenpenny Files on Your Health and More. For the last 24 years, I've done thousands of interviews. Most information has been in one way or another about vaccines, but because I'm a trained physician, board certified in emergency medicine, and I've had my own clinic since 1996, I wanted to do something that was more focused on your health. And that's where the Tenpenny Files on Your Health came from. So before I introduce to you today's special guest, Brian Reisinger, the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold Story of the Disappearing American Farmer, which is going to be a fascinating discussion. We're going to take a quick break. You won't want to miss this. We'll be right back. Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out, the heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch within our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years. Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off. Well, welcome back, everyone. Brian Reisinger grew up on a family farm in Sauk County, Wisconsin, which is in the southwest corner of the state, and is passionate about telling the hidden stories of rural America. An award-winning writer, speaker, and consultant, Brian worked with his dad on the farm from the time he could walk. Brian has written for many news and policy and cultural publications, and he's given talks across America on rural issues across the United States, doing interviews with everyone from local radios and farm shows to major national news organizations and media outlets on both the left and the right. His new book, Rich Land, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold History of a Disappearing American Farmer, readers learn the truth about America's most detrimental and unexplained socioeconomic crisis, how the family farms that fed us from the time we were cutting a swath across America from the Great Depression until the modern day is falling apart. He currently serves as president and chief content officer for Midwestern-based Platform Communications, splitting his time between a small town in Northern California, where he lives with his wife and daughter, and the family farm in Southern Wisconsin. Brian, welcome so much to the show. This is a timely topic and something I know that we're very, very interested in. So welcome so much to the Tenpenny Files on Your Health today.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the chance to talk about these issues.
You know, your story starts from when you were old enough to walk, when you were working on your family farm. So how does your upbringing impact your policy and writing skills for where you are today?
Yeah, you know, when some people ask me, where does this book come from? When you start working on it, I say, well, I started working on it when I was a kid. And the reason I say that is because we were part of a way of life that was disappearing. And as you said, I grew up working with my dad, and I could see that there were farms like ours that were going out of business, that were getting wiped out. I could see the number of kids that were getting on the school bus from dormant farms. I was in class and teachers would say, how many of you grew up on a farm? And I'd raise my hand, and there were fewer and fewer kids each year. So we knew something was happening. We knew that our way of life was disappearing. As I got older and I pursued a career off the farm in business journalism and then in public policy, while my sister continues working on the farm with my dad, is working to take it over. So I'm glad to say that they're farming, and you know, they throw me in a tractor on my days off and I help out on the business side, but my strengths were to go out and find out what's going on in the world and write about it. And as I've looked at our economy and looked at our system of government, I saw that really farms like the one I grew up on were being left behind. And I thought, We should answer the question of why is that happening? And so that was my attempt to do this. And what I found was decades of issues that have stamped out the American farmer, and that it is an issue that affects our very food supply, from the price to the type of food that we have to the security of that food and so many other issues. And so that's really how my upbringing brought me to this spot.
You know, I think there's probably a lot of reasons, a long list of reasons, actually, of why the American farmer is disappearing. I have a friend that lives in southern Georgia and took it on herself, I think this was summer before last, who just, she was looking for a good rancher to buy her beef from, actually, and was just, and took and did a self-guided tour across southern Georgia, talking to lots of different farmers there. And they were saying that the problem was, is that most people in their 20s and most young people in their 20s and 30s, they just don't want to do farming. They would rather have a white collar, you know, Wall Street type job, and they just don't want to stay on the farm. What do we do to keep the appeal and the importance of people, younger people staying on the farm? Because it's big business. Even if you're a small farmer, and I grew up on a farm. My dad was a chiropractor, but we had two farms. We had about 180 acres that he leased out. And I got to know our local farmer that farmed for us. I mean, even if you're that small, just 180 acres, it's big business. You've got variables you can't control, like the weather and bugs, and you've got, you know, pricing on what you buy things for and what you sell things for. And then you have to calculate if you've got to take a portion of that crop and feed it to animals. And I mean, it's a very complicated accounting business, and there's a lot that goes along with it. But I think that most people kind of think, oh, well, they just farm. They don't, it really doesn't have that level of importance. How do we convey that to young people to want them to be in the farming industry?
It's such a good question. And you're right. There are so many issues, economic, social, political, and technological, that have contributed to farms disappearing. One of the biggest ones is a social one, which is the number of young people who are moving off the farm, moving out of rural areas to pursue other careers. And, you know, I think the biggest thing to be able to have people there to take over the farm is we have to be able to show them that there's real economic opportunity behind it. And I wrestled with this myself. I was the fourth generation. I was the first eldest son in four generations to not farm. And part of the challenge that I had was that I didn't have the talent for crops and cattle that my dad and sister have. And I had different gifts and different passions. But I always carried around the guilt of having not farmed. And I'm so grateful that my dad has kept farming and that my sister has been working to take over as well. But I carried that around, and it was something that really followed me. And I guess the reason I raise that is, although there's other issues tied into that, you know, you grow up in these places, it gets down into your blood and your bones. And I know that for kids who grew up like I did, who have that same love for where they're from, and maybe have the skills that my sister has, many of them are not told that farming is a bright future. Most of them are told that farming is, you know, going down the tubes, and that you can't make a good living this way, and that what they're doing is outdated, or what they're doing won't work anymore. You don't have a lot of guidance counselors encouraging those kids to look at farming as a bright economic future. And the truth is that it is a deep challenge, and it's a very big crisis for our country. And so you can't blame them. But there's things that we can do to change that. There's things that we can do to create more entrepreneurial opportunity for young farmers. And I think if that happened, we have so many kids who go off and work in other parts of agriculture, which is a good thing to do. We have so many kids who go off and work in the trades, also noble work. But so many of these kids that love to work with their hands and love agriculture and love growing up, or wish they could have grown up on a farm. So many of these kids can be involved in agriculture and farming if only they thought that there was opportunity there.
That's a really, really good point, you know, because I don't think that people see that. And I don't think, I mean, what do you have a number, a handle on the number, like how many people that grew up in the city want to go out and start a farm, you know, and
That's
work on the farm?
That's a great question. I would love to know. What I can tell you is that some statistics that maybe illuminate that a little bit. So we have lost 45,000 farms per year on average for the past century. So it's 70% of our farms. And it is in the millions of people who are maybe one generation removed from the farm. You know, people who live now in a small town or a suburb or a city or another rural area who grew up on a farm. And there's a good many of those people who have an affection and a nostalgia for it. Maybe their family couldn't keep it in the farm. Maybe there were other chain or couldn't keep the farm in the family. Maybe there are other reasons for that. And then there are also the people who, whether they had a background growing up on a farm or one or two generations removed from it or not, there are the many people who are leaving urban areas, going to rural areas in the post-COVID world. You know, we had one of the, there were so many terrible things that occurred, but one thing that came out of the COVID time period was people realized they could work from different places. You know, the remote economy began to take on more steam. And also there were just people who wanted to make a change and they wanted to be free of certain things. And they didn't want to live in a city with that they felt was maybe a lifestyle that didn't fit what they wanted anymore in that time period with what was going on with COVID. And so there are actually some rural areas that had their population increase, and that doesn't happen very often. Usually it's the rural shift away from rural areas toward urban in terms of population. So I know there are a lot of people out there who would love to be in deeper touch with farm communities and be part of it. And I think that's something that we need to seize on.
Are there, like, for lack of a better term, what comes to my mind is like farming apprenticeship programs. I mean, because if I grew up in Manhattan or even downtown Cleveland, you know, because I'm from Ohio, and I wanted to go out and say, yeah, I think I want to start a farm. I mean, I wouldn't, even though I grew up on a farm many years ago, I never farmed. And so I really wouldn't even know the process and how to get involved with it and purchasing equipment and seed and when do you plant and, you know, all these different things. Are there apprenticeship programs like that?
That's a great question. There are, from the standpoint of, there are still strong 4-H and FFA, Future Farmers of America, chapters in local communities all over the country. There are places where kids can learn about agriculture and they can learn about what to do. The challenge is how to turn that into a real economic opportunity, not only because farming is so difficult and because our country has made it so easy for family farms to slip away one by one, but also because of the fact that to get into farming, there are a lot of barriers. You have to be able to locate land. You have to be able to purchase the equipment. And, you know, the reality is that so many farms that have land being passed one generation to another already have enough challenges making it work. You know, in a family like mine, the younger generation buys the farm from the older generation. They do it over time. And so there's a financial burden to doing that, but at least you have the ability to buy it over time through your family. And that's a real opportunity. And we know that. And yet still, it can be a crushing economic experience trying to keep a farm going through the decades with all of the challenges. When you add to that the challenge of, let's say you're someone who wasn't from a farm family who wants to go locate farmland, someone who wants to find land like your family had for lease, there are opportunities like that out there available. But if it's not for those farmers who are already established, getting started and trying to meet lease payments is a very difficult thing to do. And so that's why it goes back to, how can we have it so that farming and family farming can once again be more economically dynamic so that people are able to overcome those barriers because of the promise that lies on the other side?
You know, maybe some of the older farmers, you know, farmers that are, say, in their 60s or 70s, that their children have grown up and don't want to be on the farm. Maybe this is an educational opportunity for them to reach out to say that they are looking for an apprentice, and then they could come in on a lease to own sort of project. Are those available? And if they're not, maybe somebody should start it. And if they are, how broadly do people know about them?
Right. It's a great note. You're touching on one of the biggest challenges is, what does that aging farmer do when they don't have someone who's naturally going to take over their farm? Where do they turn? You know, and what kind of risks are associated with having someone outside of your family doing this with you over time? There are people who are trying to examine that issue and try to figure out, how do we decrease those risks? How do we help make it economically viable for more farmers to, you know, do that sort of process? Because it could be an incredible thing. And you're absolutely right. And the flip side of it, the thing that is such a barrier to it, is the very dilemma that we talk about with the title of the book, Land Rich, Cash Poor. What that means is, to be cash poor means you have this land that you're unable to make a good living on, that you're grinding a living out of, that's getting harder and harder each year. And yet the land is incredibly valuable. And so many farm families are faced with the dilemma of either continuing to farm and facing the day when they can't provide for their families, or turning around and selling their land and losing everything else because it's your home, it's your community, it's your heritage. And so there are a lot of farmers who would love to be able to have their farm passed on to some willing young person who would like to take it over. But to your point, those aging farmers have a hard time finding those people, and those young farmers, farm prospects, have a hard time finding a farm. And so what happens is so many families end up having to give in to the pressure to sell their land for development or any other type of use. And, you know, they get a little nest egg out of that, but they lose everything else, and they'd much rather have their farm continue.
Well, maybe that's an entrepreneurial opportunity for you there, Brian, to set up a co-op that you match these people with these people, the farmer that is looking for an apprentice and an apprentice that's looking for a farm. You know, maybe there's a business opportunity in the middle of that.
Oh, it's definitely a problem that has, there's a solution in there somewhere that I think we need many smart minds working on. Sure.
For sure. I think probably another big problem with the loss of the family farm, like you've talked about in your book, is twofold. One is, big factory farming, you know, that the big factory farms have, you know, like Purdue and all of these people have come in and bought up, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres. And so they bought up the family farm. And the other is the foreign purchase of so much of our land. You know, I've written a bit about that, and it surprised me, you know, like Bill Gates is always getting the biggest hit for that he's gone in and bought up all the land. But of the purchasers who have bought the land in America, he's like tiny. He's bought 269,000. Canada has over 12 million acres that it's bought. And so what happens when these foreign entities like Canada, the Netherlands, Italy, UK, Germany, Portugal, and China come in and buy up all the land and then buy up the family farms? I'm sure that plus the big factory farming, huge agri-farm industry is another thing that's sort of squishing down on the family farm.
Yeah, you know, to take the issue of foreign investment, it has been a very alarming thing in terms of the pace of that. So it went, the amount of land owned by foreign interests in America went up by 15% in just 2 years. So it was a really shocking spike that we had recently. And the overall amount of land owned by foreign interests is still relatively small percentage, but it's growing so rapidly that it's a very serious issue. One of the biggest concerns, to your point, is China. They're a foreign adversary that already owns a good deal of American government debt, that already does a good deal to impact and manipulate the prices that farmers receive. And now they're coming in and trying to purchase American farmland in a world where the foreign ownership of farmland is skyrocketing. And part of the reason that that's easier for them to do is, as we lose our family farms, we have our land owned by fewer, larger entities. And so a, you know, Chinese buyer could come in and make one or two deals that would have never happened if that land was owned by 100 different small individual landowners. And so that is a real challenge and a real problem. Now, farmers will tell you that there's some types of foreign investment that can be okay. There are some farm industries that like having investment from investors from friendly foreign countries saying, you know, hey, you know, this country, you know, they have a background in this industry. They're able to help with investment. And there are some farmers who would never dream of it, who would never dream of selling any of their land to anyone from another country. But in farming, there are different opinions about that. But the thing that I think is very clearly a threat and a very clearly a concern is the Chinese trying to come in and purchase our land, and the level of security risk that creates, in addition to the way that it affects our farmland.
Yeah, I think it was Wyoming in the last couple of years that China wanted to come in and buy up, I don't know how many millions of acres, and their state Senate shut it down. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, there have been states that have taken action on the federal level. It's one of the rare places where we've actually had Congress do something, and they passed some
positive way, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. They passed some initial protections that required additional reviews and things like that, but it needs to be built upon. It needs to be strengthened.
You know, you mentioned just briefly in passing about the cost of food, you know, going through the roof. Where are all those extra dollars going? I don't think they're going into the hands of the local farmers. Where are they going?
So happy you asked that. One of the biggest misconceptions out there is that when the consumer is paying more for food, the farmer must be getting more money in their pocket. Couldn't be further from the truth. And in fact, most times when the American consumer is under distress, the farmer is too, because the farmer is also dealing with increased prices for what it takes for them to produce their goods. So what happens is we have a large integrated food system that in certain ways has been a modern miracle, but in other ways has very deep vulnerabilities and problems that we need to be honest about. But one of the characteristics of that is that there are various hands that the food products pass through from the farm gate to the dinner table, and each of those hands needs to make their cut. And so by the time the food gets to the dinner table or the grocery store or the restaurant, that price that the consumer is paying, whether that goes up or down, really doesn't have an impact over here on the farmer one way or the other. The farmer is impacted by what are the commodity prices and other things like that. And again, many times when the American consumer is facing a squeeze, the American farmer is facing a squeeze as well. However, there are ways that the disappearing American farmer and that national crisis that we're in does affect food prices. And here's how. There's two ways. The first is the disruption of that supply chain. So we talked about that supply chain that exists between the farmer and the consumer. That is such an integrated supply chain now that it is so easy for one big distribution center or something like that to go down and suddenly the supply chain locks up. We saw this during COVID when farmers were trying to sell their food and consumers were trying to buy the food, and the farmers couldn't sell their food and couldn't get the price they needed, and the consumer couldn't find the food they needed. If they could, it was more expensive. That's because the supply chain's locked up. So the farmer and the consumer are suffering at the same time in that instance. The second reason is a longer term reason. The second reason that food prices are increasing will continue to increase is because innovation in this country is stalling. America has long been a leader in innovation. We're lagging in innovation now worldwide. That's all types of innovation, all industries. But in farming, when you have an industry that is so beat down year after year, and so many farms that are disappearing, and so many farms that aren't able to take part in the innovation technologically that's out there in agriculture, you have innovation, productivity not increasing at the rate that it used to. And so those supply chain disruptions mean food prices through the roof, and the lagging innovation mean we're going to have that problem going on in the future if we don't do something. And that's, of course, along with inflation and all the other issues. So the farmer and the consumer are facing the same kind of squeeze. But if we were to do something to help our farmer, we could help our consumer.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, because the farmers pay the elevated prices for the cost of seed, the cost of fertilizer, the cost of gasoline to run the tractor and the combines and all of those different things too. So we are all Americans are on the same side of the fence. But where do those extra dollars go? I mean, if I go to the store and I mean, almost on a weekly basis, I see the increases. Like for an organic pepper, like a yellow pepper or a green pepper, I mean, they're usually 30, 40 cents. Now they're $1.25 for one. I mean, where are those extra dollars? Whose pocket are those extra dollars going to?
One place that those dollars go to is the many different types of businesses in agriculture and in food and in distribution and in retail, all of the places that need to make their money on it after they've bought it and need to turn around and sell it. And so that's where that money goes. The other thing that's going on is inflation is driving the prices up for everybody. And so there's a lot of problems with our system as it stands right now. And yeah, it is a big problem and challenge that it doesn't go into the farmer's pocket. And it's one of the reasons that we need to make some big changes.
For sure. Well, we're going to take a really quick break here. Today we're talking. This is so fascinating. So many things to talk to you about because the family farm. I mean, I grew up in, like I said, I grew up on a farm. So farming is in a farm community. I mean, we used to, the town I grew up in was about 800 people out in the center of Ohio. So, most of my classmates when I was going to school grew up in a farming family. There were big farming families. Like there was one guy in my class that came from a, they had 16 kids in their family. And there was a girl in my class that had 12 kids in their family, all girls, believe it or not, of 12 of those things. So, the family farm and where our food comes from is really, really important. So we've got a lot more things coming that we need to talk about. So today, again, we're talking to Brian Reisinger, author of Rich Land Cash Poor, Rich Land Cash Poor, The Family's Hope and the untold history of the disappearing American farmer. Sit tight. You don't want to miss the rest of this. We'll be right back. We also have an apparel line on our store that has just the best things. In fact, I go and shop at my own store. I mean, I really do go and buy stuff out of my own store. They have t-shirts and sweatshirts and cups and mugs and totes. We've got a great designer. We're always adding new things all the time. And either one of those two product lines, either our private label supplements, our Opti line, the white bottles with the green leaves on it, or with the apparel store, and they're two separate stores. They do not have a single shopping cart. It's like you go in one store and get your groceries and you go to the other store and get your shoes. Well, these are two separate stores, but you can use the same affiliate code. If you use the code podcast, when you go to the checkout, you can get 10% off on everything you buy every time you go to the store. Well, welcome back, everyone. Brian, this topic is just so timely and so hot, and everybody needs to hear about it. I have a question about, you know, I'm a big, big advocate. I've talked a lot about some issues with animal husbandry, like the genetic modification of salmon. I mean, who knew that there are more than 50 vaccines for fish? I mean, who knew, right? And so I'm a big advocate for buying local and knowing your farmer or your rancher. Is pushing into that direction of individual co-ops and things like that, is that helping the family farm?
Yeah, that's part of the solution for sure. It really is. We have a food system that in some ways delivers more food than ever in unbelievable ways, but is also deeply vulnerable in disaster. And then to your point, there's also the fact that with many of these food products, we don't know what's in them. We don't know what the health is of the health value or the health harm of those products. And so having a way to buy more local food, more fresh food in local and regional economies is absolutely part of the solution, whether it is CSAs, whether it is farmers markets, whether it's going to your grocery store. Many grocery stores are willing to carry local options if their consumers ask them to do so. And so there is a real room for the local food movement to become not a way that just some people buy their food on the side, but to become a much more central way in terms of how we purchase our food. And if that were to happen, and there, I think there are a variety of government policy changes and other things that we'd need to also see to make the American family farm more viable in the natural free market. But if that were to happen, where more people were doing that, it could really be a revolution in this country. We could have more entrepreneurial opportunity for farmers because they have more places to sell more types of crops and products rather than whatever crop or product they've been locked into in the past. And they have, you know, a opportunity to feed more and more consumers who have the ability to buy more fresh local food. And so we could really make a change. You can bet that if every consumer in America made a little bit of a shift where they visit a local butcher shop or they visit a farmer's market or they press their grocery store to hold local options, you can bet the American, you know, ingenious system of entrepreneurship is going to find a way to meet that need.
You know, another place I would add to your list where I think that consumers need to push is local restaurants. You know, the local restaurants, not the big chains, you know, and things that you might eat at and things like that, but local little restaurants that are a little, you know, mom and pop sort of thing, that if you start requesting, you know, maybe you have a rancher that you really love their meat, and you go to the restaurant owner and say, you know, I don't know where you get your beef, but you may want to consider getting it from this guy who lives on the other side of town, who is buy local. And then you, then the other thing is you can market that you as the restaurant owner is like supporting and promoting local food, local produce, and things like that. And I think that there's a win-win there for everybody. It's fresh food. You know where it's coming from. You know, it's good for the restaurateur. It's good for the farmer. And I think that we've just kind of gotten lazy. And I think that we not only have we gotten lazy about what we eat, but we've gotten lazy about thinking that our voice counts.
Yeah.
Because our voice does count.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, we have this food system that is able to deliver food in all corners of the country, all manner of food from all different places. And it has led us to, in some ways, take our food supply for granted.
Yes. And
part of the problem that we have now is this massive system that we have that provides our food isn't able to deliver it at the level of prices that they used to. You know, it's so much more expensive. So the reason that we had that and the reason so many people went with it is because, well, it was cheaper. And it used to be that you could say, well, it's cheaper over here than it is to buy from a local farmer. Well, that's not really the case anymore because of the vulnerabilities to our food supply chain and because of the lagging innovation. And so if we had consumers who are willing to make a change, and maybe there's some types of food that they have to buy in conventional ways and some types of food they can buy from local sources, but if everyone moved that way a little bit, I think it would make a big change.
You know, and this whole thing that's happening now with our election process about, you know, Bobby Kennedy doing about let's make America healthy again, you know, that it's it, what it one of the things that that has done is really put the badness of our food on the table, like that we have 10,000 food ingredients that are approved that are in our food. There's 3,000 that are in any given meal sometimes if you're not buying and eating fresh foods, from all the packaged stuff and the stuff on the shelves and all those things. And so we have really a very important thing that's right in front of us about making about our food supply. And it's really important to know that if we dig in, we're going to make a great big difference.
Yeah, you know, it's an amazing moment in our country's history from the standpoint of there are people on the left and the right alike who have concerns about where their food comes from. And that's something that hasn't necessarily been the case up until more recent history, where, you know, a lot of people, whatever their political persuasion might be, are focused on what can we do to know more about where our food comes from. And I think that's a great opportunity for us to do something.
Yeah, it's a really big opportunity. You know, I listened to an interview that you did, and you were talking about bioengineering and bioengineered ingredients, which I am not a fan of at all. And because I believe that we're creating a whole new species that we really don't understand what we're doing. It's not an exact science. It's like just a gun that shoots things in there. It's not like any sort of precision. But on the other hand, we have developed things that you kind of believe are in the realm of good for the food supply. How do we balance out that Frankenfood sort of GMO and bioengineered stuff, which is very, you know, bioengineering and GMO, as you know, is very different. I've written a lot about that versus using that technology in a good way for farmers and local farmers going forward.
You know, it's such a great question. I'm glad you asked it. I think it's the kind of issue that we need to get the discussion out into the light. And as a country, we need to decide what things are okay with us and what things aren't. You know, I grew up when I was on the farm growing up, there was a really big issue with bovine growth hormone, you know, and making sure that we had non-BGH milk and non-BGH products and things like that. And that was really important to people where I'm from. And so there's been a real struggle between how to kind of have science be something that can create new opportunity and also make sure that science isn't creating real problems for us. And I think that in this country, we haven't really fully examined all that. The issue of gene editing, which is one of the things I've been talking about, is a great example. Now, science can do some scary things. You know, it can be like cloning Dolly the sheep and stuff like that. And it can be all kinds of, a lot of misuse of science is some of the things that have created some of the problems with our most processed, most packaged foods these days, right? It's also true that on the other end of the spectrum, on the other hand, you know, the creation of hybrid corn was an innovation where the seed itself was altered in a way that allowed us to grow many more types of corn, many more places, much more durable. That kind of thing can be a good thing. And so what I've said and what I think we need to do is we need to look at the issue of gene editing, of which I'm not an expert, but of which I find very interesting and fascinating. And I think that we need to have a discussion about it as a country. Figure out what types of things can we do that might have, you know, the kind of surgical adjustments to a seed crop of some kind that can allow it to grow in more places, more climates, but not create something that's unnatural. And if we can find that balance, imagine a world where, I'll give you an example. As you mentioned, I split my time between the family farm in southern Wisconsin and a small town in Northern California. In California, one of the things that many farmers have had the opportunity to do when they couldn't continue to make dairy or couldn't continue to grow crops on a certain scale is they were able to put their land in grapes. And that has been able to fuel the wine industry. And that has kept a good many small landowners able to hold on to their land because of the revenue from having their land produce grapes. What if we had a whole new generation of crops that were natural, that were safe, but that could be grown in more places and more climates, where you could have farmers who really, you know, think they only have ground to grow hay and corn, suddenly able to grow a wide variety of specialty foods. That could be a revolution that would create a whole new generation of entrepreneurial opportunity for our farms, and could really fuel a local food movement that could be much more robust. It could be something that could help the interests of the local food movement and people who care about good, pure local food. But we have to have the discussion around the science and figure out what as a society are we okay with and not. And so I try to sail into that wind and encourage us to have those discussions to figure out that balance.
I think that that's really, really brilliant. And starting at the university level, which unfortunately so many of the universities are brought out by Big Ag, are bought up by Big Ag. And so we do things for an economic purpose that may in the long run not be so good for the environment, for people, you know, and things like that. And so there needs to be a balance in there somehow. And I agree with you totally about an open discussion. Let's talk about the pros and cons of doing this, not just all the reasons, just because we can, we should, you know, that sort of thing. You know, right. There seems to be a big explosion now. And I don't know if this is happening in the local farms or where this is happening on, you know, the let them eat bugs philosophy, that now we are bug farming. Are local farmers going in that direction? Because perhaps, because I've read a lot about this, because it's a smaller footprint, it doesn't take as much intensive agricultural sort of things. Is cricket farming becoming a thing in the small farm community?
You know, that's a great question. I have to confess that I don't know a lot about it. I've read about it lightly, but I have to say that I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, it's a big deal that it's kind of, you know, they're wanting to have crickets because they're supposedly protein to replace cattle. And the same thing about cutting down on cattle because they're contributing to global warming. I listened to an online ag conference out of San Francisco. This was in the spring, and they were talking about all the pellets that and the different things they're now feeding cattle so that they don't fart so much because of the insane thing that the tiny amount of methane that's happening there is contributing to global warming. And they're trying to eliminate cattle, chickens, cows, and doing farm things and replacing them with crickets and bugs and maggots and stuff like that.
You know, other than having read about it lightly, I'm glad to say that I haven't seen that in the local farm community where I'm from.
That's good.
But I will say that I think that there's a real need for us to focus on what's natural and what can be grown out of the ground or raised with things grown out of the ground. And so many of the people who care about our environment or our health can be in league with farmers, which is to say, hey, we want crops and products that are grown naturally out of the ground. Hey, we want animal products that are raised in good ways. And it's a great irony to me that some of the people who want to make sure that we do that are also going with trying to find ways to replace our natural food sources. You know, there's a lot of processed food that's created in a lab that can be, you know, looked at as quote environmentally sustainable. They may have found a way to do that with a very small carbon footprint, but it's not natural. It was created in a petri dish. It's not something that's good for us. We don't know what will happen, you know? And the crops that grow out of the ground, the food that grows out of the ground and that's raised on that food is natural. It's something that sustained mankind for a very long time. And
so
that gives
beginning of time.
The beginning of time. It happens to work. And so I think we need to, those people who are concerned about our environment and health need to think about what is local, what is fresh, what is natural. And I think that's a better North Star than only what's environmentally sustainable, because we can have both. We can find a way to support our environment and our health and have, you know, opportunity for our farmers. But when we get to a place where we begin to lose sight of what's natural, I think that we begin to really lose our way.
I totally agree with that. You know, the Garden of Eden, God gave us everything that we needed to have. We didn't have to synthetically create or bioengineer anything. It's all ready here. Yeah. You know, you've mentioned, I'm sure you talk about this a lot in your book, which is land rich, cash poor. And the tail end part of that is The History of the Disappearing American Farmer. And you've mentioned in passing about 45,000 farms per year that are disappearing. Is this the last generation?
Boy, I hope not. That's a great question. And the numbers are so staggering and so terrifying, to your point. There is some good beneath the surface. There's some reason for hope, in addition to people caring where their food comes from and discussions like, you know, where we can try to solve some of these problems. Here's some of the good news. Although we've lost 70% of our farms in the past century, which is staggering, those 30% that are left, there's nearly 2 million farms. And this surprises people. It surprised me as I investigated this. 88% of them are small family farms. And people are often shocked by that, because the farms that we're losing are exactly those kinds of farms. And they're right. There have been so many of them wiped out. It is a crisis. But the fact that we have nearly 2 million small family farms left in this country means that there is an opportunity to do something about it. Now, people say, how can that be? How can those farms exist? You know, because it's so hard for them to make it. And the way that they exist is their supplemental income. So people are working multiple jobs. So you got farmers who own a farm on the side, and that's a little bit of income, but then they're also working on the construction site or pulling a factory shift or pouring concrete. And, you know, my family is an example of this. We grew up with a good middle-class living. My dad worked really hard to survive the farm crisis and be able to hand us a farm that was free of debt for when the next generation is ready to purchase it. And that is something that is a true blessing. But that middle-class living was slipping away as I grew up. And, you know, my sister works very hard. She works on the farm. She also has hairdressing, has a salon. And so she is an example of someone. She works in a salon, I should say. And she is an example of someone who's working multiple jobs. She's worked as a mail carrier and a bartender at different points in her life as well. And so what if we had a world where those nearly 2 million family farms could be full-time income for those families again, like it was when I was growing up and like it was in generations past? That would be a world where more of these small family farms could be growing entrepreneurial ventures, where they could have a bigger impact and provide more of our food. More of these farm families could survive. We wouldn't have to have farms being wiped out because they say, well, it just isn't even enough income anymore. It's just draining our household finances. And we could have more people have more types of food available to them in more places from more local fresh sources.
Is this something that needs to be legislatively changed? And does that need to be on more of a local level, state level, or on a federal level?
Great question. It is ultimately the biggest structural problems that we have are at the federal level. And there's probably action that state and local governments can take as well. And what I mean by that is, on the federal level, we have farm programs that I think people on the left and the right dislike. I think there are plenty of folks from outside of agriculture don't like it. There's plenty of folks from within farming that don't like what we have in one form or another. We have a whole regime of programs that have been built up over the decades. They've never really truly been reformed in a very revolutionary way. They've been piled atop one another. Some of the programs don't work the way they're supposed to. Some of them are open to abuse and favoritism. And that's why we have this world where there are some people who say, oh, well, the farmer gets all kinds of subsidies, they're just fine. Well, there are so many farms that aren't receiving their share of those subsidies, or the subsidy programs don't work the way they should. So we're both wasting money and not solving the problem. And so we need to make changes on a federal level, make those programs, the ones that are necessary, function the way they should. The ones that aren't necessary, that are causing problems, be reformed. But also, we need to do a couple of things. We need to have a research and development revolution in this country, where we have research and development that is fueling new technology, new innovation, confronting some of those dilemmas that you and I are talking about, but figuring those things out, to figure out what's economically viable, what's good for us, and how can we continue to innovate on in the future to help with food prices and food variety and all of these things. And we also need to make sure that we have trade policies that are both free and fair, where we're getting new opportunities out there, but also we're making sure that the American farmer isn't competing either internationally or domestically in an anti-competitive market. So those are the kinds of things that on a federal level, there are large problems that need to be adjusted federally. From there, there are certainly ways that states can find ways to make farming lower cost, whether it's through adjusting regulations, whether it's through reducing the tax burden. And local communities, there's a role for local communities as well in finding ways for meaningful rural regional economies. Example is the Master Cheesemaker Program in Wisconsin. That is something that in the state of Wisconsin, they created. And also it's something that local communities focus on and support. It's the only one in the country. And one of the reasons that Wisconsin is still a source of more small family farms than other states is because we have many small cheese factories along with larger dairy processors, all these sources where the milk can be sold to fuel this amazing cheese industry that has really, you know, nationally renowned. And so it's kind of a niche for Wisconsin. And so states and local communities can play a role in having their local farm community play some kind of a niche, have something that becomes the sensation of the country.
Wow. That just opens up a lot of opportunities to even think about that. You know, I remember, I can't even remember why I was reading about this, but it was many, many years ago. And they were talking about North and South Dakota and how when they decided to make North and South Dakota, it would have been a much better idea to have made an East and West Dakota, because the western side of the state is mostly big ranches, and you know, it's split by the Platte River down and everything on the western side in both North and South Dakota tends to be ranch and farmland, and on the eastern side of both the North and South Dakota is more where the cities are and universities and things like that. So it is very hard to legislate North Dakota because you've got the city side in the rancher side, you know, not always seeing in the same direction. And so I'm wondering is how many different places like that, that there seems to be conflict between what is good for the local farmer and the local rancher that's in conflict for the cities. And I think I just read, this was maybe 6 months ago, about some new legal things that they put into place against the small farmers that has to do with farm runoff, that has to do with like cattle runoff and different types of ways that now they have to clean the water before it goes into the streams and all this other stuff that was going to be cost prohibitive for small farmers to sort of be able to maintain these things. And then I think about how silly that is because, you know, every once in a while it rains, you know, and it's just like rains over the entire ranch. It's not just something that's coming out of your barn. I mean, like here in Ohio, we've had 3.5 inches of rain in the last couple of days. And so the runoff from that is just, you know, enormous. And so how many different factions impact the small farmer, from the environmental stuff and different things that would be a benefit for a city, but would be a detriment to the farmer?
It's a great question. We have a huge problem in this country that is really summed up by the concept of our rural-urban divide. You know, the degree to which we're separated, not just by different ideas about things, but by where we're from, who we are as people. It's one of our most stubborn divisions. And I think it's a real problem because there are ways that if we had urban and rural leaders who were able to find ways to work together, we could solve a lot of these problems. We could solve so many of problems that consumers are having and people living in urban economies are having by making sure that we're addressing what's going on in rural America. And, you know, a good example of this is the environmental debate. The reality is that folks who care about our environment and farmers have so many shared interests. Both of those groups of people care about our soil. You know, people who care about our environment want it to be clean and want it to be sustainable. Farmers who farm that land, they want it to be healthy because they want it to have high yields. And so many times, good environmental practices can also be good farming practices. Same thing for the issue of water, which is a huge problem. Having an abundant supply of good, clean water is something that farmers have an interest in and something that people who care about our environment care about as well. So we could be working together on how to solve those problems. And instead, we're divided over so many. I mean, and the environment is one of our most divisive debates in our country. And so it's just a good example of how the rural-urban divide and also the divisiveness of our national conversation cause so many problems where we could be solving problems.
Are there organizations or individuals like yourself that are doing things to try to bring that, to narrow that divide, to get those conversations going?
That's a good question. You know, we're trying to get the word out. We're trying to talk about it more and more. I think that one of the challenges is that so many of the organizations in this place, I'm not saying they don't exist, but we need more of them to focus on the collaborative part, because so many of the organizations in these spaces you know, it's agriculture organizations that are used to getting attacked and are defending the industry. And it's environmental organizations that are feeling that they need to fight hard to change the conversation. And there's a place for those types of things, but we don't have enough folks who are focused on trying to figure out how can we get these places to be collaborating.
Wow. Well, Brian, I feel like we could talk on for another couple of hours. This has just been such a wonderful, enlightening conversation. And your book, Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold History of Disappearing American Farmer, where's the best place that we can support you? I read somewhere that this is your first book. So it congratulations is. For doing that. You're a big writer. I mean, your writing goes out in a lot of different places, but this is your launch, is your first book. So where can we support Land Rich, Cash Poor and Brian and your work, Brian?
I appreciate it so much. It's available everywhere for folks who buy their books online. Land Rich, Cash Poor is available on Amazon and other online retailers. For people who like to support their local bookstores, it's in bookstores nationwide, and they either have it or they can order it for you. And so I appreciate anybody who picks up Land Rich, Cash Poor. And I really just hope that we can keep this conversation going and figure out a way to try to solve these issues, and that perhaps my family story woven in with these issues is something that can give people a little bit of a good story and maybe a little bit of hope about what we can do.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, I think that, just based on our conversation, I'm sure that when I dig into this book, it's going to be really delightful. You know, I said to Brian before we went live on this broadcast today that, you know, we sort of, this was a spontaneous meeting, you know, that he just stepped into the gap because our scheduled guest just had to reschedule and wasn't working. So I'm so delightful to have this with this conversation today, because we've had a lot of conversations about ranching and about farming, and it's food is such a big issue now. So it's a really, really timely topic. So thank you so much, Brian, for being here with us today. Thank you for your work and thank you for the book. And I hope that this is the beginning of some really, really good pressure, upward pressure and movement for what you're doing, and more for the local family farms, because we need more of them.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the work you're doing to highlight this issue.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank all of our listeners who come every week to listen to us. You know that this is now being posted on our Substack at dr10penny.substack.com. It goes up on Wednesday so that you can re-listen to this. If you missed popped in and halfway through this conversation tonight, you'll want to listen to the whole thing, and you want to listen to it again anyways. So join us at dr10penny.substack.com, that it will be up there on Wednesdays on the On Your Health channel. So for that, I want to thank everybody again for coming tonight. I want to close out with one of my favorite verses from the Bible that I close all of my podcasts with, whether they are live or pre-recorded, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, lean into God. He will not let you down. Thank you again so much, Brian, for being here. And to everyone else, have a great week. We'll see you here next week, same place, same time. Have a good week, good night, and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com, and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.